All right, here we go. I very much enjoyed Steve's presentation, his second affirmative, and I appreciate the fact that he tried to cover some of the things that I raised. Let me get my projector going here again. All right, here we go. And I appreciate the fact that Steve said he'd like to get into 1 Corinthians 15 and Luke chapter 20. So what I'll do, I'll just hit some highlights of the things that he said there in his second, and then I will go ahead and present some concepts that I think are pertinent to what we will continue to discuss on 1 Corinthians 15 and Luke chapter 20. Steve talked about the fact that the term Christian age does not appear anywhere in the Bible, therefore I might be misguided in making an argument about that. Well, that's certainly true. Christian age, the term Christian age does not. And Steve said he could argue that the kingdom will never end, but that doesn't mean that this phase of the kingdom does not. Well, I'd call your attention to Hebrews chapter 12 again. In Hebrews chapter 12, the writer is anticipating the radical eschatological transformation of the old covenant system, the cessation of the function of that system as it was originally designed and originally given. In other words, the temple was about to be destroyed, the genealogies were about to be destroyed, the priesthood was about to be destroyed. It was about to be removed. But the writer says, wherefore we receive a kingdom which cannot be moved. So here he talks about two systems, two covenant ages. And he says, here is one that is, oh, by the way, I'm supposed to be down here. sorry about that, Doug. All right, my apologies for that. Here we go. So here we have a discussion in Hebrews chapter 12 about one system that was established. It was organized, it functioned in a given way, but it ceased to function in that given way, and it was removed. Removed, ceasing to exist. So the old covenant age ended. Likewise, in direct contradiction, the writer says that the kingdom that they were receiving then could never be moved. Well, if being moved under the old referring to the old covenant system meant ceasing to function as divinely established, then it would therefore logically refer to the same thing in reference to Christ's kingdom. That means that Christ's kingdom would never be radically, eschatologically transformed, cease to function in the way that it was divinely established and ordained to establish. To me, there's just an anomalous situation. When God said to Adam and Eve, in the day you eat, you will surely die. And Steve admits they died spiritually that very day. But then what does he do? He extrapolates their physical death for hundreds of years. Well, that's not in that day. And I had asked and posed the question, what did God mean, or what did it mean when it said, in the day you eat, you will know good and evil? They didn't know good and evil hundreds of years later. The death that was threatened happened that day. And I pointed out some things that God did not say. And, you know, Steve emphasized, and rightly so. Well, I have no objection at all to Steve's emphasis on the fact that they were shut out from the tree of life. I'm simply pointing out that sin separates from God. And I think it's simply wrong and misguided to say that God wasn't dwelling in the garden, that the garden was not his dwelling place. By the way, it might be helpful for you to understand that all Jewish rabbis considered the garden to be the temple of God, the most holy place where God dwelt. And I mean, that's just a given in rabbinic literature. And by the way, I cited Isaiah 59, your sin has separated you from your God. That's what happened when Israel sinned. What happened when Israel sinned? Well, they were living in the land. They were living in the presence of God. What did God do? I will cast you out of my presence. And by the way, Hosea chapter 6, in referencing that, says Israel sinned just like Adam. They have broken the covenant. And just like Adam was cast out, Israel was cast out of the land of God, the presence of God. So it is absolutely true that being cast out of the garden, man was cast out of the presence of God. And, okay, let's go on. Steve says that although Israel is important, he does not believe that it is that important. Well, as I pointed out, and I think this is very important, I noted that the problem of the garden was subsumed, if you please, assimilated into, and became magnified under Torah. That's what Paul says in Romans chapter 5. death, that is the death of Adam, reigned from Adam to Moses. Now, it's real clear that the death of Adam didn't end at the law of Moses. But it says it reigned from Adam to Moses. But what happened with the entrance of the law of Moses, the law was added that sin, i.e., and therefore death, might abound. Romans 5, 20 and 21. So the Adamic death that entered through Adam, wherefore as by one man sin entered the world, and death through sin, therefore death passed upon all men, because all men sinned. By the way, it raises an interesting question. If sin brings biological death, then why is it that infants who have no sin whatsoever die? This is a very severe problem. Going to have to take the position that Adam's, that the curse of biological death passes on infants who have no sin whatsoever. I have a real difficult time accepting that position. And I know that Steve's not a Calvinist, doesn't accept, you know, most of Calvinism. So to me, that's a very, very severe problem. But let's consider whether or not Israel is really the focus. In Acts chapter 24, when Paul talked about the resurrection. Now, Steve is going to argue that the resurrection is the consummation of all things, right? It's the end of the Christian age, although the term Christian age is not there. So it's the climax. Resurrection is everything. Where did Paul say he got his resurrection doctrine? Paul said, I believe all things that are written in the law and the prophets, that there's about to be, that's the Greek of the text, from the Greek word melo. Mellow in the infinitive means about to be, means imminent. Paul said, I believe all things that are written in the law and the prophets, that there's about to be the resurrection of the just and the unjust. And by the way, I ask the question, Paul said, my doctrine of the resurrection of the just and unjust is from the Old Testament. Daniel chapter 12 predicted the resurrection of the just and the unjust in AD 70. Steve agrees. But Steve says, Paul's doctrine of the just and the unjust is not Daniel chapter 12. So I ask, where is that passage? Where is the passage in the Old Testament that predicts the resurrection of the just and the unjust at the end of the current age? Now, Steve probably didn't have time. And boy, we both know the stress of trying to cover everything. All right? So I'm not accusing Steve of trying to avoid it. It's probably a stress of time. I try to cover everything. I obviously didn't get to everything. But my point is this. The Adamic death, notice what Paul does in 1 Corinthians 15. As in Adam, there's the original problem, right? No matter how we believe it to what we believe it to be. As in Adam, all men die, even so in Christ shall all be made alive. Now, where did Paul posit the solution to the Adamic death? Well, in 1 Corinthians 15, 54 and following, Paul says, when the mortal has put on immortality, when the corruptible has put on incorruptibility, then shall be brought to pass the saying, death is swallowed up in victory. O grave, where is your victory? Now, he quotes Isaiah 25 and Hosea chapter 13, verse 14. So where is Paul getting his doctrine of the resurrection? From God's promises to Old Covenant Israel. Now, if Israel, therefore, is not the focus, why didn't Paul bring in some other prophecies dealing with non-Israel promises? Instead, notice what Paul is doing. As in Adam, all men die, even so in Christ shall all be made alive. When? When these two prophecies are fulfilled. By the way, I would suggest to you there are five major Old Testament prophecies that Paul is drawing from in 1 Corinthians 15. But for the time being, I want to address 1 Corinthians 15 as a little bit of an introduction, but I want to look at 1 Corinthians 15, verses 12 to 19, to address some of the things that Steve said. Paul said there were some at Corinth who were denying physical resurrection. I don't think that's the problem at all. Those in Corinth were denying resurrection to a specific group of people. And when we follow the Greek text especially, but we don't have to have the Greek text, it's in the English as well, some translations better than others, this becomes abundantly clear. I want you to notice that Paul uses a form of argumentation that's known as modus ponens. It's otherwise known as the if-then form of argumentation. Paul takes what the Corinthian scoffers either believe or do not believe. And he turns their belief, their accepted views, What happened? Excuse me. Okay, yeah. Paul takes what they either do believe and says, if you believe this, then you must believe that. And his point of arguing that is saying, well, wait a minute, I don't believe that. But Paul says, wait a minute, if you're going to believe this, you've got to believe that. Because Paul wants them to recoil in horror at the implications of their own statements. Paul is saying, if you believe this, then this is not true. And Paul wants them to say, whoa, wait a minute. But that is true. And Paul says, but you can't argue this without arguing that. Let's look at that. Paul is using the things that the scoffers either do or do not use or believe to prove the resurrection of the dead ones. That's the literal translation. Now the scoffers, now watch this very carefully, folks. Follow along in 1 Corinthians 15, 12 to 19. The scoffers did believe that Christ had been raised from the dead. Now, just think about this. If they were denying the physical resurrection, then they're going to deny Jesus' physical resurrection. But Paul said, if the dead ones are not raised, then Christ is not raised. Now, if they're denying physical resurrection, they would have gone, well, of course that's what we're denying, Paul. What's your point? That's precisely what we're arguing. But they clearly do not believe, or they're clearly not denying Jesus' physical resurrection. By the way, I don't deny that either. I affirm the physical resurrection of Jesus wholeheartedly. Now watch this. They did not believe that their faith was in vain. Notice what Paul says? If the dead ones are not raised, your faith is in vain. Now remember, if they don't believe in physical resurrection, they should have said, Paul, that's exactly right. We don't have faith anymore. We've abandoned the faith. Obviously not what they're saying. They did not believe the apostles were false witnesses. Think about this. Paul says, if Christ is not raised, and if the dead ones do not raise, we the apostles are found false witness. That would have been the perfect opportunity for these guys to say, Paul, that's precisely what we're saying. You're a liar. We don't believe a word you're saying anymore. It's not what they were saying. Now watch this. If the dead ones are not raised, you, the deniers, you are yet in your sin. Do we really believe that those people were standing back going, Paul, we're a bunch of sinners. We've not been redeemed. We've not been saved. This is all a bunch of hooey. Because you see, if they were denying the resurrection, then Paul's argument would have fallen on totally deaf ears. If the dead ones are not raised, you're in your sin. They should have replied, were they denying the physical resurrection, as Steve argues? They should have argued and admitted, Paul, you are precisely right. We are yet in our sin. But watch. Paul says, if the dead ones are not raised, then those who have fallen asleep in Christ have also perished. Now, notice the dichotomy that they draw between the dead ones and those who have died in Christ. Those are two distinct groups. They are denying that the dead ones would have resurrection life. They are clearly not denying that those who had died in Christ had resurrection life. Or else, once again, Paul's argument just completely falls. As one theologian said, Paul's logic is absolutely, totally false. Paul was a horrible logician. Well, I don't happen to believe that personally. I think Paul was an absolutely masterful logician. Now, I want you to notice something because this is very critical. In 1 Corinthians 15, 19, it says, Christ has become the first fruit. Now, I'm going to talk more about that momentarily because Steve brought it up, and it's an important concept. Christ became the first fruit, he doesn't say, of the dead. That is a bad translation. It is literally, Christ is the first fruits of those who had fallen asleep. Christ is the first fruit in Paul's argument, in Paul's logic, not of Christians who had died, although one might extrapolate and say, well, he certainly could be that, but that's not Paul's point. Paul's point is that Christ was the first fruits of those who had died before Christ rose. This is the group that is being denied resurrection life. Now, let me go on. That's all I'll take the time to cover right now. So let's talk about Luke chapter 20. And I'm not even going to use that. Jesus said, in the age to come, they neither marry nor are given in marriage. And I know Steve understands this to be a problem. When I was studying coveted eschatology, I believed it was a problem myself. I believe the Bible answers this definitively. Under the Old Covenant, according to Deuteronomy chapter 23, a eunuch, follow this very carefully, a eunuch could not enter the tabernacle or the temple of God and worship God there. He could not offer his own sacrifices. Why? Well, he's called a dry tree. Why? Well, because the Old Covenant kingdom was not only manifested, but it was sustained and grew. How? Through the natural conjugal relationships of marrying and giving in marriage. Therefore, they were cut off. But in Isaiah chapter 56, God foretold the time in which not only foreigners, i.e. Gentiles, i.e. pagans, would be invited into the Messianic temple and be given a place within the walls. But he also said, and the eunuchs will no longer be called dry trees. Eunuchs who physically could not fulfill the mandate of Genesis 1:28, be fruitful and multiply, who could not fulfill the mandate of Exodus, be fruitful and multiply, or Deuteronomy, of entering into the land. But eunuchs under the new Messianic temple could be fruitful and multiply. How? Not physically, not through marrying and giving in marriage. Now Jesus, when he said, they neither marry giving in marriage, is referring directly to Deuteronomy chapter 25 and the Levirate marriage. That was a part of the Mosaic covenant. A man died without bearing children. He didn't have any children to pass on his inheritance. Did not bear any sons of God to carry on the kingdom, to spread the kingdom. He had become a dry tree in that sense. So his brother had to marry his widow and produce children of God for the kingdom. Jesus said in the age to come, that won't happen. Now watch this. In Acts chapter 8, the Ethiopian eunuch is converted. Now I used to think that the emphasis was on Ethiopian, but it's not. In the Greek, the emphasis is on eunuch. Why is the emphasis on eunuch? Because here is a man who is now, in fulfillment of Isaiah chapter 56, being invited into the Messianic temple, and he can be fruitful of and multiply. How? Well, just like Paul said in Colossians chapter 1. Writing to the Colossians, he said, the gospel has come unto you, as it has also come into all the world, and is bearing fruit everywhere. This eunuch, just like Paul, just like Peter, just like any other person, could share the gospel of Jesus Christ, and that gospel of Jesus Christ would bring forth sons of God. How? Through resurrection, by faith. And that's how Jesus said sons of God would be produced in the age to come. By the way, Jesus said in the age to come, they'll neither marry nor give any marriage. Paul said those in Christ are neither male nor female. Jesus said in the age to come, they will not die. Jesus said, if a man keep my saying, what? He will never die. So the precise situation that Isaiah predicted in the age to come, the Messianic age, the age of the kingdom, in which eunuchs would become fruitful trees producing sons of God, but not through conjugal relationships, was coming to a reality manifested, magnified in the conversion of the eunuch in Acts chapter 8. Here is the fulfillment of kingdom prophecy, because guess what? The age to come was breaking in. If any man is in Christ, he is a new creation, the very new creation that was promised under the old covenant system. So what we see here, by the way, this is in fulfillment of God's old covenant promises made to old covenant Israel. What did Paul say? I'll close on this. And now, having obtained help from God, I preach no other things. Nothing else. Now, so therefore, if there's another eschatology, or if there's a greater eschatology, if there's a different eschatology from that focused in, assimilated into Israel, Paul didn't know about it. And Paul said, I preach nothing but what Moses and the prophets said should happen. He said, for the hope of Israel am I in chains. For the hope of the promise of the resurrection am I on trial. Well, if the resurrection is greater than Israel, Paul didn't know about it. because his doctrine of the resurrection was from Moses and the prophets. Thank you so much.